It's 8:01, Monday, August the 16th, and you're listening to WAIF Cincinnati, 88.3 FM. Good morning and welcome to the Master Gardener Hour, the shortest hour in radio. Good morning, this is John Duke. I'll be your host until 9 o'clock. My guest today is Joe Boggs from Hamilton County Extension to talk about a wide range of interesting gardening topics. My friend, Master Gardener B.B. Terry, is also here with us again to help out in the studio and jump in with the conversation. Should be interesting. WAIF FM, as a community radio station, serves only to open its airwaves to responsible and divergent points of view. The opinions expressed during the Master Gardener Hour do not reflect the views of WAIF, its staff, or Board of Trustees. The opinions expressed reflect my own views or the views of my guests, which may change at any moment. It's 8:03, and you're listening to WAIF Cincinnati, 88.3 FM, the Real Stepchild Radio, what radio is meant to be. My theme music for the show is Coconuts on the CD Nature's Bounty by Mystical Moods. If you have any comments or suggestions, we invite you to write us at the station. Send your letters to WAIF FM, 1434 East McMillan Avenue, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45206. I want to say hello to Joe Boggs.
Oh, hello, John. How are you doing this
morning?
Fine.
And Bibby, good morning again.
Hi, John. How are you this morning?
Glad you all could join us.
Thank you.
Very glad to be here.
I think, Joe, I'd like to start with you and just tell a little bit about yourself and your background. I know you're a famous Master Gardener teacher.
Well, infamous, maybe. I like that disavowing the knowledge of your guests at the beginning. Well, yes, we do teach, and I say we because I'm with Ohio State University Extension. My role with Extension is I'm 50% in Hamilton County as an Extension educator, and then 50% I cover the entire state as a horticulture specialist. But when I say we, there are over 2,000 people involved with Ohio State University Extension throughout the state, and many of those people are involved with master gardening programs. Extension educators, formerly known as agents, have been doing the program in the state for quite some time, and we're very proud of it. So consequently, I get to have the honor of teaching about 20 to 25 different programs a year, mostly entomology, as you recall, through that, talking about insects, and then a little bit on turf grass management, and then quite a lot on diagnostics.
Yeah.
And that's diagnostics of plant problems.
Yeah, right. That's more of your hands-on.
Exactly.
Where you go over to Spring Grove and tromp around and look for bugs
look
and
for
fungus
things,
and things.
Look for interesting things and interesting plants.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. Not far from here, Spring Grove Cemetery and Arboretum. Largest collection of state champion trees anywhere in the state. So, a lot of people think of cemeteries only being one purpose, but it's a very nice park-like setting and a great place to see plants as well as things that interest me, those things that make plants look bad.
Well, now, what's your favorite thing to teach? Entomology?
I have to say entomology.
Yeah.
That really is. It's my master's degree is in entomology from Ohio State, and so it's my first love in terms of science.
Uh-huh.
But, on a broader on a broader look, I love to teach Master Gardeners. They're one of the best groups to teach, John. And well, any listeners that are interested in gardening, it's a great program.
Yeah. A lot of us were empty vessels.
Oh, listen to you.
That's when we started.
No, I know better.
Well, the thing I like about the Master Gardener program is that the more I learned, the more I realized I didn't know.
Well, that's all of us, John. I'll tell you that the nice thing about both interacting with Master Gardeners and teaching is that we learn just as much. You know, you hear that from instructors occasionally, but it's very true of this program. And and as you know, just such a wide range of really interesting and talented people.
Yeah.
Not empty vessels. And you're underestimating your knowledge when I met you, because it was pretty considerable.
Well, you're located out there in Tri-County on...
We're right behind...
on Boggs Lane.
Tri-County, yeah.
Did they name that after you? Is
Boggs Lane. That is kind of interesting. You know, I looked into this. Our office actually moved. We were on Winton Road.
Right.
And when we made the move, of course, we looked around at all kinds of different spaces and so forth. Came down to this one. And it turned out, just coincidentally, apparently in the Springdale area, there have been Boggses for some time.
Uh-huh.
Now, my family is originally from West Virginia, prior to that, North Carolina, so it turns out we're not related to those Boggses. So it was totally coincidental. Plus, I started looking into what are the probabilities of there being, you know, our office on Boggs Lane for Joe Boggs. The downside is that when people call and ask my address, I think sometimes they think I'm working on my basement or something. Yeah, Boggs Lane. But I don't think there are any other streets in Cincinnati. I mean, people could call and tell us, but I've looked, you know, with Boggs associated
with
it.
Well, you just found the place is right for you, I guess.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I'm really hoping 275.
You're never there anyway.
Well, that's true. I'm out driving 275, which I hope becomes Boggs Bypass. Old David Letterman joke there.
Okay. Well, tell the folks where you are and tell them about the hotline, too.
Well, that's an outstanding point. Now, we're located at an office building, TriView Office Building. It's just behind, up the street a little ways from the Tri-County Mall.
Mm-hmm.
And this year we started a horticulture hotline, and it's totally operated by Master Gardeners.
Okay.
So when you call in to the number, which is 946-8999, you are able to, on Monday and Wednesdays, so far we just have it 10 till 2 on Monday and Wednesdays, you're able to tap into a cadre of information on gardening and other challenges. I'll tell you, it's been one of the most rewarding things I've done since coming to Extension about 12 years ago. We're having a lot of fun with it, too.
Yeah, I bet you are.
Yeah, learning quite a bit. Last week, for example, this very peculiar, the gentleman described it as a plant from Mars. It was growing in his driveway. You've probably,
No.
You've worked with the hotline with the Civic Garden.
Yes, I have,
right.
Yes.
And so, you know, you get all kinds of really neat
calls. Yeah, you get some
calls.
Strange questions.
And so this was growing on a gravel driveway, and it was a sloped gravel driveway. Now, a plant growing on gravel, you know, you have to imagine it's going to be small, it's going to be close to the ground. And so, indeed, these are real fleshy green leaves that were very close to the ground. Well, it turns out the plant is called liverwort.
Huh.
And it actually used to be used for medicinal purposes in the Middle Ages. But it lacks a vascular system, meaning that there are no roots. And so this thing has to kind of cling to an area where there's quite a bit of moisture.
Now, was it an epiphyte?
No, it's actually called a bryophyte. It's in a little different plant group. And it's what's interesting about it, it's actually more closely related, John, I'm putting it into the plant taxonomy.
Uh-huh.
It's a little more closely related to algae.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Almost like an organized algae, organized into a form. But it's a different. The botanists out there are probably groaning with my, you know. As a botanist, I'm a great entomologist. Remember that. But my point is that it really is a plant that requires moisture. Now, this gentleman had his driveway looked at by a paver, by a contractor, and the guy was so taken aback by this stuff. He said he wouldn't come back till he got rid of it.
Huh.
So the fellow was looking for a control method, which is usually what we think of. Okay, let's first But, you know, if you remember from the Master Gardener teaching and your work with the diagnostics line at Civic Garden Center, sometimes one problem can lead to a more serious, disclosing a more serious problem.
Uh-huh.
In this case, the more serious problem was you have a plant that requires a lot of moisture on a gravel driveway that the homeowner wanted to pave. Now, that means there had to be some type of spring, some type of water coming out, and it turns out that he said there was, but only during wet periods. And so we often call those wet weather springs. Nonetheless, that still wouldn't be a good thing to have below a paved driveway.
Sure.
So he's going to look into fixing the drainage because that water in the winter would freeze and thaw and hoove his blacktop. So you could really thank the liverwort for disclosing a problem that may save him a lot of money down the road.
Sure. Oh, that's interesting. You do get a lot of funny questions on the hotline.
That's
I remember
true.
Somebody called in and said they had an elm tree and it died. And what should they do?
Oh, yeah.
and I said, well, do you have a fireplace?
Yeah. Well, that's true. That's true. And those calls where you know the tree is mostly dead, and how do they save it?
You don't resuscitate them very well.
Well, and it is an interesting thing because we do work with subjects that can't talk. And that's probably the greatest challenge. You know, if we were physicians and working with people, obviously, people can describe their symptoms and can describe what's wrong with them.
You don't talk to your plants, or you talk to them, but they don't talk
well,
back.
Well, you know, here I'm going to go back to this. You'll disavow the opinions, non-displaying. You will display. Yeah, I like the way you said that. Change your opinions. Well, I have to think about that. That though does present a real challenge because you can't ask how are you feeling. You can't ask how long has this been going on. So if you're going to work with a diagnostician, a person who is working with diagnosing plant problems, then you really do need to think through the kind of information that's important. You need to speak on the behalf of the plant, in other words. Tell the person how old you are. Tell the person, for example, when did these problems first start appearing.
Mm-hmm.
And then get a very good look and a very good kind of summary in your mind of how much is being affected.
Yeah.
Because, as you know, I had a branch about a year ago that was dead off of an oak tree.
Uh-huh.
And it has still had a few, leaves clinging to it. And then I asked, well, how much of the tree looks this way? And the person said, well, that's the only branch that had any leaves on it at all. The rest of it was, and it wasn't looking very good. I think the chainsaw was my end. Yeah,
right, Well, I recall, and I still use it from time to time, and I don't know whether it was your invention or you got it from somewhere else, the 20 questions.
Oh, 20 questions of plant diagnostics.
Yeah, so useful. It just leads you right through to...
Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, to be fair, that was actually developed with Jim Chatfield.
Okay.
Who is my counterpart, Ohio State University Extension. He's in Northeast Ohio.
Okay.
And then the third person on that was Eric Draper. He's the Extension Educator in Geauga County.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, this is a funny story, how that came about. For years, we've been trying to teach diagnostics, which is pretty tough. I mean, how you do it, how I do it, everybody approaches it a little different. So we were trying to decide how do we come up with a way to at least help people to understand the process.
Yeah.
It's not that, as you know, John, and remember when I taught it, I didn't say, you start checking off 1 through 20 and call the person back and say, well, I'm only to 15. I know it's a week later, but I haven't answered all the questions. You really do need to just think of this in terms of helping you learn the rigors.
Yeah.
Learn the proper stuff. We actually came up with this whole thing walking at Spring Grove Cemetery and Arboretum a couple of years ago. We'd struggled with it. We had a number of conference calls and finally the three of us got together and walked around with a notebook and just talked about how do we do this thing? How do we actually diagnose problems? So that, has been published in a number of places, was where it started.
It's a very useful tool.
Well, thank you.
And especially for me and probably a lot of other people who haven't seen a lot of these problems in the real world. I mean, you've seen a lot. You can go out there and you don't need the 20 questions. You just jump and you say, well, that's Phytophthora.
Well, that's kind of you. But no, I'll tell you, it's still a it's still something that I have to think about. Now, if you remember, the very first, this isn't one of the 20 questions, but it was the number one diagnostic rule. Now, you guys are looking at me like, oh, yeah, oh, no, a quiz. Oh. But the number one diagnostic rule is not to make the symptoms fit the diagnosis. Remember that? Don't make the symptoms. And that's where a person says, you know, I know what that is already.
Yeah,
so everything I see, you know, physicians can get in a big trouble doing that. If they think they already know what the problem is,
so
everything they look at you, they're going to make that into their diagnosis. So don't make the symptoms fit the diagnosis. Make the diagnosis fit the symptoms. Now, I fell down on my number one rule just last week. We had a tomato sample in at the hotline. It turned out to be, well, I'll get ahead. Do you have to take a break here? Or?
Oh, we're gonna talk for another 10 or 15 minutes.
Let me know. You've got a big fly swatter. The listeners can't see
this. I'll break in when we have to do something here.
John gave me a big fly swatter, and I told him he'd better probably hang on to it to get me to be quiet. But last week we had a tomato sample, ripened fruit. The plants were healthy, about 40 plants, and that's unfortunate. That's a lot of plants. Plants were healthy looking, but the fruit, each fruit had these circular depressions, circular places, spots, if you will.
Dark.
They hadn't darkened. You're
okay.
Doing the diet. Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. And that was the kicker right there, because normally when we see circular spots on the fruit and the center dark, like a bullseye almost.
Yeah.
It leads us very quickly to a fungal disease problem, and that's what we call the fruiting structure in the center. That's where the spores of the fungus comes from. Well, this didn't have it. If you looked at it under a microscope, it just looked like the center was full of disorganized tissue. It didn't really look like it belonged there. Well, when I first looked at it, of course, you all know, what's the most important thing in my heart is an insect, and so I immediately tried to make it into an insect. You know, I tried to take it that direction, and there are insects called plant bugs. Some people might know them as stink bugs. There's one called tarnished plant bug, and they have sucking mouth parts. And what they do is they inject enzymes into whatever they're going to feed on, and that dissolves the tissue. And then they use those sucking mouth parts like a soda straw. Yeah, that's right, sucking up a Pepsi. Well, in this case, that's what I thought it was because I'd seen that before. Remember, the plants were healthy.
Uh-huh.
And most fungal disease problems on garden plants do not only affect the fruit, they also affect the plant. So that's where, plant bugs don't feed on the plant. In this case, they feed on the fruit. Well, looked at it a little more. And, of course, like I said, the first thing out of my mouth was, I think it's a plant bug. Turns out that it was a disease called anthracnose on tomatoes. Now that's kind of interesting because you are probably, anthracnose, so like sycamore anthracnose, that causes the leaves to drop, these diseases. Well, anthracnose is just a general name for a disease. It would be like people used to get fevers, fevers covered everything.
Uh-huh.
So in this case, it's just called anthracnose. That's not really the fungal disease name. It only affects the fruit. And what had happened is we got the sample before the fungus disclosed itself, before it showed us by the dark center. Again, don't make the symptoms fit the diagnosis, and that's exactly. Oh yeah, for the listeners again, John's holding on anthracnose diseases of shade trees.
Right.
Well, we have a great Ohio State has a great fact sheet on anthracnose of tomatoes. For listeners, they can see all of our fact sheets at Ohio Line, that's one word, on the web, ohioline.osu.edu, and even great pictures. But again, I learned something. I had never seen that disease before.
Ohio Line stands for, or the line stands for, Link to Information, News, and Education. I think that's pretty neat.
Well, that's outstanding. I actually didn't know that, John.
Yeah.
Just real quickly, John. Joe, did that affect all the fruit on all 40 plants?
Well, I'm glad you asked, and that was the this was a heartbreaker. I mean, we all get these questions where we often think, health problems, that, but people, of course, put a lot of effort in, and this we all have gardens. We put a lot of effort into that. 40 plants, and it was an older couple, and they were planning on canning those tomatoes. Now, the downside is you could cut out the area infection, there wasn't that many spots.
Right.
The downside is the fungus can impart an off flavor, and that was happening. Oh. They said they were trying to eat these tomatoes, but they just didn't taste right.
Hmm.
So 40 plants, no canning this year. Yeah, it was. And you might say, well, why? And listeners are probably, why don't you just spray? Why don't you just? Well, if you remember too, all the fungi that we deal with on plants, I shouldn't say all, most, typically once the infection starts, meaning it's in the plant, then our fungicides won't touch it. And there are no fungicides that you can apply that are going to be taken up by the plant to protect it. So once it's infected, you're pretty well done. And in this case, they're done for the season.
I got to tell you about my little tomato patch. I've got, I planted 8 plants. Starting from seed, because you can get more interesting varieties.
Oh, yeah.
So I planted 8 plants, different varieties from seed.
Any heirlooms?
And no.
Okay.
No. These are new weird stuff.
But why doesn't that surprise me in your garden, John?
I planted them in compost.
Oh, yeah.
And they just grew like crazy.
Oh,
we got more tomatoes off of those 8 plants than...
Just straight compost.
Yeah.
I'll be darned. That's outstanding. We have a strobe light going off.
Yeah, that's the phone. That's not.
Oh, us. Okay. That's, well, I thought that was the compost calling in. Yeah.
No.
I'm doing fine.
But we're getting a lot of tomatoes off. They were a little slow to ripen up. I think everybody's having that trouble this year.
Yes. Yeah.
But I got white flies.
Hamburger.
I got white flies on my tomatoes, like you would believe.
Oh, that's terrible.
But they don't seem to be doing anything. They don't seem to hurt the fruit.
You know,
I sprayed them with Safer Soap, and they just keep coming.
It's getting back to that. I'm glad you brought that up, because looking out, so this is a great radio station, because you can look right out on a nice view. But urban area, and a lot of people think they can't grow tomatoes in town.
Oh yeah.
This year we built a house, and I haven't gotten a garden established in the backyard. So out of desperation, I put my tomatoes in containers, and they're doing fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm actually wondering if I want to, go to the trouble of rototilling and all next year. So just a large container.
You shouldn't rototill anyway. Kills your worms.
There you go. That's out.
Yeah.
And who taught soil? Good for you.
And I think he also taught us that when you build a new house, they take all the good topsoil away and sell it someplace else.
Yeah. My topsoil's somewhere up around Dayton, I think. Yeah, that's right. That's an excellent point about rototilling.
But, they make these little containers now where you grow tomatoes upside down. Have you seen those?
No, I haven't seen those.
They were selling them at some conference I was at, and I was...
I've heard about them.
I asked about the people that were selling them, company that was selling them, and I said, how do the roots know to grow up? Because all the other plants I ever saw, the roots know to grow down.
That's right. They're positively, you guys are actually earning extra Master Gardener points.
Please, because I need them badly.
And she just said, well, they just do, which wasn't a suitable answer to me.
Well, is it not to the side? Because that is a good question.
Well, it's like a hanging basket that you turn upside down.
Now, that's very odd.
And I don't know.
That's very odd.
I mean, it's in a container, so I guess the roots go where the moisture is, maybe, or something.
Well, that's true, but you might... Well, that would be interesting to look into. I've heard of those, I thought... Well, they were just talking about Australia. Everything's upside down there,
But they do work, apparently. So. Okay. What other kinds of services do you folks offer over there?
Well, we also, I'm pleased you said you asked that, John, because we sometimes forget that we have these different offerings from OSU Extension. One of our marquee programs is actually the 4-H program.
Isn't that a great program?
It is just fantastic. And Kevler Holly, our 4-H educator, has really moved the program, which a lot of listeners are probably thinking, 4-H, is that, cows and horses? But there are tremendous components that are targeted towards urban youth, and Kevler Holly's done a great job with that. Really, it should be called youth leadership.
Yeah.
My children were in it, and I hate to say it, I wasn't, because the county I grew up in, West Virginia, Extension wasn't doing well, and they didn't have a 4-H agent. But youth leadership. My son, for example, was in 4-H, and it was, and I hadn't noticed before. It's coeducational.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Young girls and young boys are together. Uh-huh. The leadership is shared.
Is it 9 to 19? Is that
9 to 19? Yeah. Outstanding. Yeah. That's exactly right. So a wide coverage, mm-hmm, of children at all ages, and it teaches a lot of I've found firsthand with my children. It teaches a lot of outstanding values that we, yeah, try to teach our children. Well, confidence is a big issue that 4-H really helps with.
I got to volunteer over at Boone County at the fair to register the 4-H kids' vegetables.
Fill
out the paper stuff on it. And that I did that last year, and that is so much fun because these kids are so wonderful.
Oh, and they really are. They're really fired up on their projects.
Oh, yeah.
And again, if you contact, and that's, I'm glad you brought that up because I don't want to minimize my colleagues in the other two states. Extension, I should have said this earlier, Extension started in 1912. 1914. Oh, you got me on that. I just lost a point. The instructor is now down 1 point. In 1914, it started connected with land-grant universities.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in our area, we have three that we think of. The pinnacle one is Ohio State. Oh, my gosh. The lights are flashing with Collins.
Hmm. Throw in Kentucky.
And University of Kentucky, outstanding. And, of course, Purdue University. And each of those land grants then have, through extension, an office in each of the counties. So Boone, Campbell, and Kenton County, outstanding extension, mm-hmm, programs, as does all of the counties in Indiana that our listeners, yeah, may be in, and, of course, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have 4-H programs. Also in each office, you have...
They don't all have Master Gardener programs, though.
They don't all have
Master Gardener programs. Warren County is just starting.
Just starting one. Boone County's had one. Claremont County has a program, started not long after ours. But you're right, John. And I kind of remember the number. In Ohio, there are 88 counties. So I got that question right.
Very good.
Thank you. And I think it's up to 58 counties have Master Gardener programs.
Yeah.
Now, some counties, of course, do it jointly.
Mm-hmm.
Three or four counties involved,
right.
But it's a fantastic program.
Yeah.
And, of course, also in each office, aside from 4-H, we also have community development and then family and consumer sciences. And that used to be called home economics. Mm-hmm. But, again, outstanding programs, money management programs, for example, mm-hmm, with FCS, family and consumer sciences. So we're very proud of the breadth of information. Although, as we started off talking, as I inadvertently did right at the beginning, sometimes we only focus on one small area. In this case, it's insects, and that's the most important thing, right?
Absolutely.
Extra credit.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think it's 29 minutes after 8, and you're listening to the Master Gardener Hour, the shortest hour in radio, with your host John Duke and my guest Joe Boggs and Bibby Terry on WAIF Cincinnati 88.3 FM. You can listen to the Master Gardener Hour here every Monday this summer from 8 to 9 a.m. And I think Bibby's got some information for our listeners.
I do, and it just so happens all of it has to do with gardening, which is wonderful. I was so glad today, John, to know that Joe was going to be here, because as part of the Master Gardener program, there are not too many people who could make 27 people sit rapt listening to bugs, but Joe definitely did, except for that nitrogen bus, Joe. I haven't figured that one out. But let me real quickly do these public service announcements. The first one is on the Cincinnati Zoo, which is just such a treasure here in Cincinnati, and we, as part of the Master Gardener program, Bobby Strangfeld has just done a wonderful job of taking us on field trips, and we spent an entire day at the Cincinnati Zoo, and I think we saw two animals, a peacock and an aardvark, and that's it. The rest of the time, we were looking at the just incredible botanical gardens, and so this one is Visit the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden, located at 3400 Vine Street in Avondale. The gates open at 9 a.m., and the park closes at dusk. For more information about the zoo, call 281-4700, but please, if you go, I know they're wonderful, wonderful animals. I think some baby rhinos, too.
Yeah.
But please take a look at the gardens. It's just a marvelous place. Lots of trial gardens. The pansies last year were so incredible, and it's just a wonderful
place. The Master Gardener
Association
is meeting over there tonight. Actually,
they're meeting over there tonight.
To look at the annual trials.
That's exactly right. I got a little note about that. And the other one is another place that we were fortunate enough to get to visit, and that's the Crone Conservatory, mm-hmm. which is just unbelievable. Check out what's growing at the Crone, located in Eden Park. The admission is free, but donations are accepted and certainly appreciated. But it is a wonderful place. It's not just for master gardeners. It's a wonderful place to take the family. The rainforest is incredible. Incredible. The things that you'll see are just unbelievable. And for more information on the Crone Conservatory, call 421-5707. And our last one is a show that's here on WAIF, and we did this one last week and just loved doing it. Lots of Southerners here, so this is actually about a program called Cutting the Grass, and hear the best in traditional bluegrass every Saturday morning from 8 to 11 a.m. on the Cutting the Grass Show. Your hosts, Lee Elliott and Moonbeam, will feature the music of Bill Monroe, the Stanley Brothers, Jimmy Martin, the Osborne Brothers, and many others each week. Tune in to WAIF on Saturday morning starting at 8 a.m. for the finest mix of bluegrass music. And since you already have your radio turned to WAIF to listen to the Master Gardener Hour, you can just keep it there and turn it on Saturday morning to hear Cutting the Grass. So thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you, Bibby.
Wow, that's outstanding. I have to get in here. I'm a big bluegrass fan. Of course, growing up in West Virginia, that's
prerequisite. Saturday morning.
I wrote that down.
Yeah.
That's outstanding.
And about 3 weeks ago, Lee Elliott and Moonbeam, who do that show normally, mm-hmm. played something. And I was in the car and turned it on and just caught the middle of it. It was country humor.
Oh, yeah.
And it was so funny. It was the funniest thing you've ever heard in your life. And I was driving the car, so I couldn't even write stuff down, so I've forgotten most of it. But
I had this experience this morning. I hope you weren't going down the highway and just laughing maniacally.
Right. Yeah. One of the lines I remember was the guy was saying, when I was a kid, I was so poor, my daddy had to get a cosigner to pay cash.
I like the one, our family tree so bad, it's just a stick.
Yeah. Oh, God. Is that my mama was so poor that she had to put me and my brother in the same diaper.
Oh my God.
It's the only way she could make ends meet.
Well, I hate to say this. Are these are jokes? I mean, this
yeah.
is like...
Well...
I grew up with this.
You're from West Virginia. You get all that stuff.
I thought that was the way it was. You know, it is interesting. There's a great group. I know we're getting far afield, but called Bering Strait. And they're actually from Russia, and fantastic bluegrass
group.
Okay,
I'm sure Lee knows all about them.
Oh, that's
he's an expert in it.
Oh well, far more than I know. But now let's getting back to what little I do know. You know, we're talking diagnostics, and John, you and I talked about this beforehand. That it isn't just important to know, you know, what may be affecting a plant just for the sake of knowledge, or maybe. You know, applying a bit of a control measure. But we do have some problems important for all of us to know. And, of course, one has made the news in the last mm-hmm. couple of years. It's called the emerald ash mm-hmm. borer. Now, that's a beetle that was inadvertently brought here. We don't know exactly how long ago, but we think in the neighborhood of 10 to 15 years ago, landed in the Detroit area. So it was brought here probably in packing material because it's a wood-boring insect. A native Asian beetle. Now, the problem with getting non-native insects often means that they didn't grow up with our trees. In this case, emerald ash borer did not grow up with our native ash trees, which are considerable. That's one mm-hmm. of our most common trees in Ohio,
yeah.
3.8 billion just white ash in Ohio. And
wow.
So consequently, the native trees have no defenses. And this insect typically uh-huh. kills a tree once it starts infesting in about 2 to 3 years.
Huh.
And we really don't have anything like it.
Seems like I read where up around Columbus, there was something like 16,000 trees.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, John. And as a matter of fact, just to help listeners, because we don't want to introduce this subject and then, you know, and leave indicating that, you know, ash trees are all in trouble. So far, of course, the area of infestation in the United States is Detroit. and then it's moved out from Detroit. You know, everybody pictures in their mind, like I have to, you know, geographically, unless we all have maps in front of us. It's moved out from Detroit into the northwest part of Ohio, so up around Toledo. That's where we found almost all of our infestations. Again, found in 2002 in the Detroit area, 2003, then we found these infestations around Toledo. It hasn't gone any further that we know of in Ohio, except for this one spot over in the northeast quadrant of Franklin County, over in the Polaris area. And it turns out there were 8 trees that were shipped down from a Michigan nursery. Of course, being an Ohio State, or we know nothing good ever comes from Michigan anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, the lights are flashing again. The colors are... You're going to disavow now. I retract that because there are some outstanding researchers at Michigan State working on this problem along with entomologists from Ohio State. Nonetheless, that one infestation meant that it turned out eventually 16,000 trees were taken down. Listeners are probably wondering, why didn't they just take the 8 down? Well, currently, anytime you find an infested tree outside this Detroit area and Toledo area, all ash trees within 1/2 mile are going to be taken down.
Because that's the range of the insect? Or?
So far, it doesn't look like that they're going to move from one location further than that. Now, some listeners may say, well, no, wait a second. I seem to hear that they can fly 10 to 12 miles. And that's true in a laboratory.
Hmm.
And this is, you know, entomologists devise all kinds of interesting ways to torture insects, I guess. But but to learn, you know, how far they can go. And these are called flight chambers. And it's where they tether an insect. And the floor of the chamber is striped. And it moves almost like a conveyor belt. So the insect thinks that the ground is moving and their wings are flying. And so they just... John's looking at me. I'm demonstrating this with my arms, you know. And and moving around the room.
You really should be more of a television personality, Joe.
No, I have a face for radio, believe me. But my point is then they fly to exhaustion. And in this case, you know, they found that these insects can fly 10 to 12 miles. I don't know how they keep them going. They have a picture of Woody Woodpecker behind them or something. Some predator.
Some bird.
Yeah. But that's not likely to happen in the real world. This is in a laboratory. In the real world, a female emerald ash borer is going to fly to the next ash tree.
Yeah.
So
they don't. They're not that mobile, really.
But
you got to play it safe. So
you
got
to
wipe out all the ash trees.
So these 8 trees were positioned out. They're planted out far enough till if you drew a circle with a radius of
half mile.
That would encompass all these. Now, it turned out it was about 11,000 ash trees of size. But then they went back and actually had to remove, because we learned later. Now, we used to teach, and this is what happens as research moves along and we learn from it. And again, I want to stress, and this is just a little after my Michigan comment. I'm fear that there's that's a Wolverines at the door. That's good. But at Michigan State, an outstanding entomologist named Deb McCullough, and then at Ohio State, an outstanding entomologist named Dan Herms, who got his PhD from Michigan State, they've been collaborating and continuing to develop new information along with Ohio Department of Agriculture and USDA scientists. This has had a lot of very focused and well-directed attention. So, for example, that half mile, we feel pretty safe about it. But we also started out teaching, and I started out teaching, the first information was about 1.5-inch diameter trees or above.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if something was, you know, smaller than 1.5-inch, we didn't worry much about it. Well, the research has now been conducted just outside of East Lansing at a plot inside where the ash borer is now endemic, has shown that they can go down, they can infest stock down about the size of your thumb. They can go down about 3/4 inch.
Wow.
So in Franklin County, they had to go back and remove all these extra trees.
Mm. Okay. That is under control for the time being, I suppose.
In Franklin County, it is, and in northwest Ohio, these eradication efforts are working well. But I want to get very quickly, if people have a suspicion here in the greater Cincinnati area, what should they be looking for? Because ash has a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are, in fact, a couple of native borers, you know, insects that bore into trees. Now, these native borers produce round holes. And so if you see round holes of no, it doesn't matter the size, don't be concerned about it. Emerald ash borer, the adult has a flat back. If you look head on to the insect, it's got a round belly and a flat back. So when it emerges, it creates what we call a D-shaped emergence hole. Looks like a circle, a half a circle.
Yeah.
And so if an ash tree has these D-shaped emergence holes, well, that's one clue. And nothing else that we have does that in ash.
Okay.
Now, some listeners may be saying, well, I've seen those on birch trees, so did this insect go to birch trees? Well, there's a sister species that's native to the United States called bronze birch borer, another insect. And, in fact, we've long learned that it produces D-shaped emergence holes on birch trees. But on ash, D-shaped, you know, could be death.
So that's what you're looking for, and that should be reported to...
Well, quite frankly, the Ohio Department of Agriculture should be one of your first calls early on, except we are trying to help build, you know, the first suspicions.
Yeah.
Those D-shaped holes, it's amazing when you look at these trees how many holes can look D-shaped. One thing we're discovering, for example, some of the borers, other insects that aren't emerald ash borer, as they emerge, sometimes there'll be a bark of flap of bark, rather, that will make the hole look a little D-shaped. So we've learned another trick is to just take a pocket knife and just kind of cut away just the very surface of the bark. And it's amazing. All the holes so far, thank goodness, and great Cincinnati I've looked at, have turned round after looking
D-shaped. That's good.
John, can I ask Joe just one real quick question? When we were driving to Michigan about a month ago, and we saw a number of signs along the highway that said, "Do not move your wood piles."
That's right.
Is that I mean, can the borers still live, and they're afraid that people have cut these down and they could spread it doing that, like selling the wood or something?
Absolutely, that's a very good question because the insect will not attack dying trees. Which is different than bronze birch borer. It actually goes after stress trees. This insect seems to be, well, I shouldn't say it that way. I said that kind of wrong. They're not drawn to stress trees. They will attack them, but they're not drawn to stress trees. They're indiscriminate, though. They'll attack healthy trees. But what we do know that they won't infest would be firewood laying on the ground. However, they take 1 year to go from egg to adult. So, and those eggs are actually being laid even as we speak. They're out there cavorting around.
Yeah, they do that.
That's right. Insects, you know, they're discussing the weather, you know, waiting for the OSU-Michigan game and all that stuff. So those eggs are being laid right now. Once the eggs hatch, then these very interesting larvae, we call those immature insects of this type, larvae, develop. And I have to tell you, that's the other key. If someone pulls bark off in the winter of an ash tree that's dying, and they find these little larvae that look like, I describe them and others have described them, they look like miniature tapeworms. I know John's like, they have they do not have any legs. Okay. They're white, and each segment, you remember these caterpillars and all that, each segment is bell-shaped, very distinctly almost triangular. And frankly, you know, going back to my undergraduate degrees in biology and had a lot of parasitology, and when I first saw one of these, I thought, by golly, that looks exactly like a tapeworm. So if you see a tapeworm, you're going to find anything else like that. And then the larvae feed in the most unusual manner. They feed beneath the bark, on mostly the phloem, that part of the food flows through phloem. And they leave behind in their galleries their frass. Now, we won't exactly describe what frass is, but in this case, it's what exudes out of the back of the insect, but it looks like sawdust. And it's packed very tightly, very fine-looking sawdust packed tightly in these galleries. So, three things, emerald ash borer, D-shaped emergence holes, tapeworm-like larvae beneath the bark, and then frass that's filling, and this is the final thing, the mines that they produce, the galleries they produce, I should say, are going to be S-shaped or serpentine. They look like a snake path beneath the bark. Very distinct.
Okay.
Now, getting back to your the concern we have, let's say a tree right now is taken down. And we know that eggs have been laid for quite some time. They had actually started in early summer. We know those eggs have hatched. So we know larvae are starting to develop. If a tree is taken down right now and then brought as firewood to Cincinnati, there could be a possibility that those larvae would complete the development of those logs.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we do know that's one source of infestation. Although we're starting to think, you know, it depends on the time of year that you take these down. And, John, you're probably wondering, well, if that's true, then what about these trees they're taking down in a half-mile area from infested trees? Well, those get ground up, and they actually get sent to a power plant back up in Michigan as chips to be burnt.
To burn.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
You guys are on your seats. I can
well,
see
I want. No, I wanted to ask you about... another thing these nasty insects do that I read recently, and I don't know whether you've heard of this or not. We're talking about global warming and all the carbon dioxide that human activity produces. There are other sources of carbon dioxide.
Cows.
Yeah. Everybody know about the cows. But any decaying organic matter produces a carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. Even if it's anaerobic, you get methane, which oxidizes very quickly to carbon dioxide. And I read in a book, the guy didn't cite it, but he just made the statement that insect flatulence may produce more carbon dioxide than human air pollution. Now, that boggles my mind.
The image that comes to mind boggles. I'm sorry, Lee. So the crickets chirping at night, that's not all they're doing. What is that other noise?
Well, you know, we all know about the cows, but I had never thought about the insects. But, you know, if you look at not just insects, but the millipedes and the earthworms and everything else, that's a substantial... weight of organic.
Put Beano on.
I know Beano on. Okay, listeners, I disavow any knowledge. The opinions expressed here. Well, you know, that is interesting because these are living, respiring organisms, and all kinds of things do happen. Now, I won't go into any details here, but you've actually struck a chord. Most insects probably don't emit a lot out of the back end, and here's the reason why. I'm not saying they wouldn't, but when you and this goes back, and I'm hoping that I can create a bunch of budding entomologists out there, just really fired up on learning more.
You have your PhD in insect flatulence.
If you look at an insect's digestive tract,
okay,
they actually do something very interesting that we don't do, and that is that as the food goes through the gut, it gets to a place that would be very similar to our large intestine. It would be analogous to it. Now, for people, that our food passes through this spaghetti-like, structure called the small and large intestine. With insects, once it gets there, there are these tubes that lead out of that large intestine area back up into what's called the crop, or the right before the stomach. And they're kind of interesting, they're called Malpighian tubules, named after the person that discovered them. Now, what they do is they actually extract moisture from that food. So this is why, for example, if you look at a butterfly or butterfly caterpillar or a moth caterpillar, the pellets that we call frass that come out the other end are they're like pills. They're very dry.
And they don't have the anaerobic bacteria producing methane.
That's exactly right, John. It makes it at the anus, at the very end of the it makes the conditions extremely dry, and then we find that the bacterial load in an insect gut isn't like higher organisms.
Okay.
Now, we actually depend, and hooved animals like cattle depend on even more microbial activity to help break down our food further. But that symbiotic relationship, and that means two organisms living for mutual benefit.
Right.
That doesn't quite exist with insects. Frass is, believe it or not, remarkably clean. Not edible.
When that gets wet from weather, that will decay.
Decay. And it really, the bigger picture here, and the one that is the comment. I'm not saying some insects do not produce wet feces, but this is all part of carbon cycling.
Sure,
and absolutely. And it has been known for quite some time now. Once we recognize the concern over carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, the role between insects and plants, and I should say arthropods, that in terms of recycling carbon.
Yeah. Well, I know you have an interest in dinosaurs and history and all that kind of stuff. And I also read recently where somebody took an air bubble from 80 million years ago out of amber.
Yeah.
And analyzed it, and it was 30% oxygen instead of the 20 we have now. And they're speculating that the oxygen in the atmosphere used to be a lot higher than it is now.
Yeah.
And that may have had some influence on the demise or the decline of the dinosaurs before that last...
Well, that's interesting.
Because, you know, dinosaurs are big animals. They need a lot of oxygen. Mm-hmm. And if they start getting starved for oxygen, they may tend to go into decline.
That's a good point.
And I've always thought it was more the emergence of the flowering plants that they wouldn't eat because they ate the gymnosperms.
Yeah.
And that forced them into the colder climates and higher altitudes, which would still mean less oxygen, I guess.
It's an interesting thing. I'm sorry for listeners. This is an
we get off the track.
But this was an inside joke when John said about 30% oxygen. At some point, when we teach entomology in a Master Gardener program, remember the question always comes up: why, on my way down here, for example, why did I not see signs, insect crossings?
Yeah,
you know, like deer crossing. Why are there no huge insects? And as a matter of fact, if you go to different places, if you go to our Cincinnati Museum of Natural History, you'll see some fossils of some fairly big dragonfly wings.
Uh-huh.
And at one time, dragonflies had
big
wings of like 3 feet wide. The reason why I was laughing, John, it brings to mind, and this is going to date me badly, but remember that old Ringo Starr movie with something like Caveman? He played a caveman. Oh, no, you're looking like... And at some point, they're laying, you know, just kind of under the stars, just you know, getting ready to go to sleep, and you hear this big buzzing sound, and this giant dragonfly lands on the guy next to Ringo, and I mean, it's big. It's like three, and of course, what's he do? He reaches over and smacks it on this guy's face, which, you know, that always draws a little bit of a laugh, but the point is that there were large insects.
Yeah.
Insects do not have... They don't have lungs. They don't breathe like we do. They have to take oxygen directly through their body walls, through holes we call spiracles, and then through tubes we call trachea, right to the cells. It means that they're very inefficient at taking in oxygen. So the bigger they get, the farther these channels have to travel with oxygen. So when there was 30% in the atmosphere, it supported big insects. And I think they actually ate the dinosaurs.
That could be. Okay. On that note,
oh my
gosh, we're kind of getting a little low on time here.
A little credibility, let's be honest.
Get that last water out.
I did want to mention a couple of upcoming events that are going to be coming along pretty soon here. The Master Gardener Program at Hamilton County is going to run from September the 8th through December the 8th, but I understand that class is full.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But you can still get on the list for the next one.
Exactly.
So you can call Bobby Strangfeld at 946-8986. And the Northern Kentucky Master Gardener class is running about the same time. It's going to be on Tuesdays from 9 to 1 p.m. September 7th through December the 14th at Campbell County at the Extension Office. And you can call there and find out about that at 859-572-2600. And let's see. The Landfair Retirement Community is offering a free class on houseplants on Wednesday, September 15th at 2 p.m. And you can call Nancy and sign up for that. It's free at 591-4501. And the Master Composter classes at the Civic Garden Center are going to be running again in October, starting October 2nd on three consecutive Saturdays. And that number to call is 221-0981. And Linda Kreidler's little shop, which is a nice little place if you haven't been to it, is it's called Urban Eden. It's at 1313 Main Street, and they're only open from noon to 6 p.m. on Wednesdays through Saturdays, and that's a fun place to visit. They got all kinds of garden doodads down there. And that Linda's number is 624-0333. Next week, my guest is going to be Linda Kreidler to talk about garden design, including some hardscaping information. So tune in next week to hear all kinds of useful and fascinating things about gardening. Linda, I think, will be glad to get back on the radio. She was my mentor.
Oh, yeah.
And taught me how to run the radio station.
Oh, that's outstanding.
And did you know that WAIF depends on you, our listeners, for financial support? We are an all-volunteer, nonprofit community radio station. For $15, you can become a member of WAIF FM. You can join on the webpage at www.waif883.org. And if you want to listen to previous programs of the Master Gardener Hour until at least WAIF gets their archiving working again, you can go to the webpage for the American Compost Society, which is www.writethisforme.com/ACS, and click on the Master Gardener Hour link, and you can listen to all of the previous Master Gardener shows. Let's see. Joe, do you have anything, any final thoughts?
Well, I just want to thank you for inviting me down and having me on the show.
Delighted that you're here.
Yeah, and my entomological friends are going to be envious. I actually got to say Malpighian tubules on the radio.
Yeah, wow.
That's a dream come true, let me tell you.
Well, I gave you a lot more airtime than Ron Wilson, so.
Oh, well, I appreciate
that. And not once did he call you Buggy Joe Bob.
Well, yeah. I am just pretty buggy, though. I tell you, that's but it's really been a pleasure, John. You're doing an outstanding job.
Well, thank you. I'm having fun.
I can tell.
We've had some good guests on, so let's see. We start this off. This has been the Master Gardener Hour with John Duke. You can listen to the Master Gardener Hour every Monday morning this summer from 8 to 9 a.m. on WAIF Cincinnati, 88.3 FM. All we ask is 1 hour a week. We welcome your comments and suggestions, so please send a note to WAIF, 1434 East McMillan Avenue, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45206, in care of the Master Gardener Hour. I'll be back next Monday. My guest will be Linda Kreidler, fascinating personality who's missed being on the radio, so don't miss it. That's only 167 hours from now, so make them count. And stay tuned for One Voice. And take care of yourself. Your garden needs you. Thanks for listening.